Aspirin is one of the most common medicines in the world. It's used to treat everyday aches and pains and has been shown to help prevent heart attacks, strokes, and even some cancers. Joining us now for today's Please Explain to explore how aspirin works are Dr. Alan Arslan, assistant professor in the departments of obstetrics and gynecology and environmental medicine at NYU Langone Medical Center, and Dermot Jeffries, author of Aspirin, The Remarkable Story of a Wonder Drug, which is published by Bloomsbury. Welcome to our show.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Alan, what is aspirin made of? Is it a natural substance?
Well, aspirin itself is a synthetic substance, which is basically acetyl salicylic acid. But it's actually based on the natural compound which was found originally in the willow bark and other plants. So this willow bark contains the naturally occurring salicylates, which are basically the basis of the aspirin action. And Felix Hoffmann, a German scientist, chemist actually, working for the Bayer company, was able to modify the salicylic acid to create acetyl salicylic acid, which is known as aspirin.
Well, Dermot, did people know it might have this effect? What was it being used for before Felix Hoffmann actually came up with the idea of creating aspirin?
Well, you can actually trace the origins of aspirin way back to the ancient Egyptians, and even earlier than that. Back to 2 or 3,000 years BC, people were using willow bark then in kind of ground up as a paste, and they were drinking it along with beer, and it would help reduce their aches and pains. Now, they had no idea of the science behind it or why this worked, in common with a lot of sort of herbal treatments of the time, and indeed throughout early pre-scientific history, people tried out remedies to see if they'd worked. This one did work. But it's fascinating that nature contains so many of the modern medicines that we now use today, that they have their origins in the natural remedies of the past. And this one was very effective. It was used by, passed on by the ancient Egyptians onto the ancient Greeks, onto Hippocrates, obviously one of the earliest medical philosophers, and through him to very venerable medical philosophers like Galen and Dioscorides and all these people back in the Roman era. Then it kind of disappeared from view for hundreds of years. It just fell out of use, as these things often do. And it wasn't until about the middle years of the 18th century that it began to fall back into use again. And then that wasn't because they were thinking that it was an aches and pains remedy, but because they thought it might be a cure for malaria.
But then Felix Hoffmann had the idea of putting it into pill form with the idea of it treating headaches, or were they still thinking about malaria at the time?
No. Well, essentially what had happened was that in between, Felix Hoffmann came along at he was working for Farbenfabrikant Bayer & Co., which is a German-based dye company. You know, they made dyes to color clothes.
In this country, we call it Bayer, right?
Bayer, that's right, yeah. Exactly. And they had not long since got into the manufacture of medicines because it was a profitable way to use some of the chemical leftover products of the dye production process. And one of the things that had been used to make dye was coal tar, which was the residue also left over from gaslight. Back in those days, they used gaslight. And this noxious black gunge was a kind of wonderful concoction of different chemicals. And out of this first came the first synthetic dyes, but also it proved the basis for a kind of pharmaceutical revolution, if you like, because people began to realize that it had substances that could synthetically be turned into medicines. And so what had happened was is that somebody some years prior to Hoffmann had actually discovered what the substance was, had identified salicylic acid as being the key ingredient in aspirin. But people had tried and had indeed synthetically manufactured it. But on its own, it was very unpleasant to take because of its corrosive effects on the stomach. But what Felix Hoffmann did, and there's some debate about whether or not it was him or one of his colleagues, but anyway, what Bayer did was manage to combine salicylic acid with, to make it acetyl salicylic acid, they put a little bit of hydrogen in, if you like, and essentially they came up with a compound that wasn't so unpleasant to take and didn't have so many obvious effects on the stomach. And it was originally supposed to be marketed as a treatment for rheumatic fever, but it was only after that actually it went on sale that people began to realize it had this extraordinary analgesic properties, pain-relieving properties as well.
So, Alan, how does aspirin work on the body?
Well, it's actually amazing. It has so many different mechanisms of action. The principal action, it basically blocks the synthesis of prostaglandins, which is pro-inflammatory molecules, which are very important for inflammation. That's why it has anti-inflammatory effects. It also blocks the synthesis of thromboxane, A2, which is very important for platelets to stick together, and that's why it has antiplatelet effect, and which may also be related to its one of its complications, which is a gastrointestinal bleeding.
Let me stop you for a second. It some people have problems. What does it do? It causes bleeding in the stomach.
Yes, one of the complications of taking large doses of aspirin is bleeding. So,
well, how does something that causes bleeding in the stomach have such a powerful effect on a headache?
Well, because it has different mechanisms of action. So it has analgesic effects, and it has antiplatelet effects, and it also has anti-inflammatory effects. And now we're finding out that it has additional effects potentially on cardiovascular disease and potentially cancer. So it looks like aspirin has multiple mechanisms of action. And the main effects work through the blocking synthesis of prostaglandins and thromboxanes.
My guests are Dr. Alan Arslan, Assistant Professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology and Environmental Medicine at NYU Langone Medical Center, and Dermot Jeffries, author of Aspirin, The Remarkable Story of a Wonder Drug, published by Bloomsbury. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and we're taking your calls at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a question or a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Since it has so many different applications, it has been called a wonder drug, a miracle drug. Is that a fair description?
Well, I mean, I don't know what Alan thinks, but I think it is possibly the most remarkable medicine in the pharmaceutical cabinet, if you like. It has this extraordinary range of actions. You know, in very small doses, very small 75 milligram doses, it can both prevent heart attacks, and also, if you've had a heart attack, it can prevent you having another one. It can also prevent strokes because of its effect on the blood, its thinning effect, to use a kind of layman's expression. It can also prevent strokes and diseases associated with clotting, which some people think also includes things like Alzheimer's. But its extraordinary effects may also range, as we now know, because of all the many tests, to cancers, to many common cancers that are obviously serious diseases, and having a drug that can, which is so cheap, I mean, it costs less than a cent, I guess, in American terms, less than a cent a pill, and at a time when the big pharmaceutical companies will charge you many tens of dollars for drugs which are even less effective than aspirin, I think that qualifies it as a wonder drug. I mean, it's an extraordinary substance.
Now, I want to get into the cancers in a moment, but how is dosage determined, and what happens when people take too much aspirin? Alan?
Well, the original dose, which is 325 milligrams, was actually determined based on the old willow bark kind of equivalent of current aspirins, which was basically 5 stones in old English use. So it's 325 is considered a kind of standard dose, but more recently there is smaller doses like 75 and 81 milligram that are quite commonly used and has been shown to be effective for prevention of heart disease and stroke.
Now, there are many different brands out there. We mentioned Bayer, there's Bufferin, there are a lot of store brands. Are they all pretty much the same thing?
This is one of the astonishing things about aspirin's story, is that a great many people over the years have made huge sums of money selling exactly the same product. Now, some companies will add on things such as caffeine or a coating to make it easy to swallow, they've invented, obviously, soluble versions of aspirin. But essentially, all they're really selling is acetyl salicylic acid, which is plain old ordinary aspirin. That's the bit that does the work. And remarkably, I mean, aspirin's story is littered with a huge commercial wars that took place throughout the 40s and 50s, particularly in the US and in Europe, as various companies, you know, came up with these, used television advertising to try and sell these different products. And it wasn't until other analgesics came along, Tylenol and ibuprofen, you know, to name two, that actually aspirin was had any effective challenges. So essentially, those for a long time they were selling the same product. Now there are these other drugs which for the last 20, 30 years have been around, which do similar kind of headache relieving, pain relieving things as aspirin. What they won't do, of course, is all these other remarkable things that aspirin does do.
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll find out how they all can take care of headaches. Some of them can be anti-inflammatory, others not. And we'll be taking your calls. Our number here is 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests are Dermot Jeffries, whose book Aspirin, The Remarkable Story of a Wonder Drug, is published by Bloomsbury, and Dr. Alan Arslan, who's assistant professor in the departments of obstetrics and gynecology and environmental medicine at NYU Langone Medical Center. Stay with us. And we're back with our guests, Dr. Alan Arslan and Dermot Jeffries, and we're talking about aspirin on today's Please Explain. People have been writing in and calling in, so let's address a couple of their questions. Begin with a listener from Manhattan who says, how does magnesium salicylate for backache relief differ in its action from acetyl salicylate in aspirin? Is there much of a difference?
Well, yeah, there is some difference in terms of the chemical structure, but basically they have the same mechanism of action, and the main ingredient is acetyl salicylic acid, which basically is the main active compound in these two.
Let's take a call. Our first caller is Susan from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a question about C-reactive protein, which is a marker for heart disease. So does it specifically target that? I know it's an inflammation marker, but I don't know. I mean, does it affect that, or is it just inflammation in general that it affects?
Yeah, so what aspirin does essentially in simple terms, and Alan will give you the science of this, but in simple terms, what aspirin does about heart disease is it prevents the blood from clotting, and it's blood clots which basically cause a lot of heart attacks and indeed strokes. And aspirin's chemical effect is to kind of make that process. It acts on things called prostaglandins, which are parts of your blood, and it essentially it stops those coming together to form a blood clot, and that's its crucial action. It's not so much that it's a marker, but it's a preventer, if you like.
So,
Alan, I'm sure we'll fill in on the science of that.
Well, and Alan, you can join in on this. So if somebody is a candidate for a stroke, would that person do well to take a small dose of aspirin every day?
Yeah, if somebody is at high risk for stroke or heart disease, there is very strong evidence from clinical trials that daily use of low-dose aspirin will have a protective effect against stroke and heart disease.
Do you want to add anything to what Diarmaid said?
Yeah, regarding the C-reactive protein, it's a very non-specific markers of inflammation. So it basically tells you that there is an inflammatory process in the body. So and aspirin, if somebody is taking aspirin, this actually may lower the levels of CRP, as it's known, because aspirin has a general anti-inflammatory effect.
Let's take another call. This is Barbara. Hi, Barbara, you're on the air.
Hi. I truly believe aspirin is a wonder drug. I've been taking it all my life for arthritis, starting when I was in my 20s. I'm 78 now, and I learned how to take it. You have to take it properly. Never on an empty stomach. Drink water, milk, something. And it is a marvelous pain reliever, also, of course, anti-inflammatory. And I learned this from my father when I was a very young woman. He was a toxicologist, and he truly believed that aspirin was the wonder drug.
Well, thank you for your call. Along these lines, a listener who had a severe allergic reaction to aspirin was told to avoid eating whole mustard seeds because they naturally contain salicylic acid. Is that why mustard plasters were used to help reduce fever once upon a time?
Yes, it is.
That's very plausible, I think, yeah.
Well, see, I'm learning things every minute here. Edward,
It's very interesting. It's very interesting. Just to interrupt, there was a study carried out in Dundee University in Scotland a few years ago, and one of the extraordinary things it found, it looked at basically at the level of salicylates in ordinary fruit and vegetables. And one of the things they found was that in organic fruit and vegetables, i.e. that's fruit and vegetables which are grown without modern pesticides and fertilizers, that in traditionally grown organic fruit and vegetables, salicylate levels are very, very high. But that in modern or fruit and veg which is grown under modern conditions, if you like, using fertilizers, salicylate levels are comparatively low. And one of the interesting things is, if you look back historically, the back to the start of the early 20th century, when fertilizers and wide-scale industrial agriculture became very widespread, that's when that basically happened, when people started using fertilizers on fruit and veg, and the salicylate level began to decline. That was also around about the same time that many of the modern diseases that we associate with 21st century lifestyle, you know, which is heart disease and things of that sort, and obviously there's a connection to people's lifestyle as well, but the levels of those began to grow significantly. And so what the people doing this study then discovered, or then began to explore, was the effect of eating salicylate-heavy fruit and vegetables, equivalent to your mustard plaster, if you like, which is another way it delivers it, on people's hearts. And clearly, there's a very beneficial effect. It's difficult to measure because of the size of the study, but nevertheless, there was something there which was recognizably an effect. And I think that's fascinating.
Maud in Park Slope asks, salicylic acid is used in a lot of topical acne medications. Is that because it reduces inflammation? Also, is salicylic acid from willow bark any safer than the manufactured synthesized type?
Well, yes. For acne, it's used mainly for its anti-inflammatory effects, and willow bark will have salicylate, but it will be very impure. And acetyl salicylic acid is a very purified form of the drug. So, taking willow bark may not achieve the desired effect.
You'd have to eat an awful lot of it, too, wouldn't
yes.
you? I think you'd have to eat your way through a tree to have it have an effect at all.
Diarmaid, it was a relatively new drug during the flu pandemic of 1918. And wasn't it used as a treatment?
Well, the thing about that was this happened after the at the end of the First World War or the Great War, and flu swept across the world, obviously in the States too, but in a Europe ravaged by war and refugees traveling around and so on and so forth. Flu traveled very easily, but there was no vaccine, no cure for it at that time. But the one drug which actually went some way towards relieving some of the symptoms of flu, which you could argue at least has prevents you from slipping into some of the secondary conditions that are associated with flu, was aspirin, because it allowed it reduced temperatures and it eased aches and pains and so on and so forth. It was one of the few remedies which actually had any effect whatsoever. Let's not forget that this was a flu epidemic which killed upwards of 50 million people, and I think that's a conservative estimate now. So it was clearly that there was a desperate need for some medicine. In fact, one of the reasons why aspirin became so popular in the 20s and 30s, the 1920s and 1930s, was because so many people had begun to take it during the flu epidemic, and they realized its beneficial effects. It was the best ad campaign that you could have possibly imagined.
Let's take another call. Francis from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. I know this is a little bit off track, but I was doing some research and I heard that the aspirin giant Bayer, during World War II, in Auschwitz concentration camp, they were doing experiments with aspirins and the inmates. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, what happened was is that Bayer became, in the 1920s and 30s, Bayer became part of a wider organization called IG Farben. And IG Farben, for various reasons, was also making other chemicals and other chemical products. And one of those was synthetic rubber and petrol. And they built a massive factory next door to Auschwitz. And when people were selected for whether or not they were to be healthy or to go off to the gas chambers, the healthy ones were sent off to work in the IG Farben factory. So it was one of the reasons why Auschwitz actually existed was because of IG Farben. And Bayer was a crucial part of IG Farben. Now, one of the things, there was some sort of irony in this, in that actually there was an awful lot of people dying in appalling and living in appalling conditions and dying because of inadequacy of their treatment, even in what was laughably known as the camp hospital. You couldn't get a Bayer aspirin to treat any of the people there. On the other side of the camp, you had Dr. Mengele, the famous angel of Auschwitz. He was actually using a variety of Bayer preparations to test out on inmates. Now, actually, it's not known whether or not one of those preparations was in fact aspirin or not, but certainly aspirin money, the money that Bayer made out of aspirin, helped pay for some of those experiments, because he was doing other experiments for Bayer involving drugs for typhus and so on and so forth. So the connection's not direct, but there is a connection.
There was a split in the Bayer company. Bayer America was no longer connected to the one in Germany. A listener, Herb in Yonkers, says he's been told that an article in Ophthalmology says aspirin can increase the risk of developing cataracts, macular degeneration, and even blindness. Alan, is that true?
Yes, there is some evidence to support this. There are several papers that has linked aspirin to cataracts, this has to be confirmed in the larger studies.
Can you tell us about your research into aspirin's possible applications to certain cancers? Which cancers in particular?
Well, here at NYU, we did several studies on aspirin, and one that we looked at first was the effects of aspirin in ovarian cancer in the large prospective cohort that we have here called NYU Women Health Study. And what we found is that women who were taking aspirin regularly, at least three times a week, for 6 months or longer, they had about 40% reduction in relative risk compared to women who did not take aspirin for ovarian cancer. So this was interesting. And then we did similar study for lung cancer, and we also found that women who were taking regularly aspirin, we also had lower risk for lung cancer compared to non-users.
That kind of news might make some people want to start taking aspirins every day. Is that a good idea?
Well, yeah, go ahead, Dermot.
Well, I was just going to say, and this is an important point to make, aspirin is not a panacea. It's not a cure-all. It has some remarkable effects, and it will do some wonderful things. But like all modern medicines, you shouldn't overuse it or just take it on spec. For instance, children under the age of 16 here in Europe, this is the case, I'm pretty sure it's the case in the States too, shouldn't take it at all because it can cause a condition called Reye's disease in children.
So what is the alternative for those children?
Well, there's paracetamol, as we call it in the UK, which is Tylenol.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Tylenol there. Or indeed ibuprofen. There are other medicines.
And do ibuprofen, which is Advil and Tylenol, do they work in the same way in dealing with inflammations and with headaches, or is the process totally different?
Well, they work basically the same way in terms of inflammation and headaches, but aspirin is much stronger in terms of antiplatelet effect, which is main effect for heart disease prevention. So aspirin has much stronger effect than ibuprofen and particularly Tylenol in terms of heart disease prevention.
You were saying something else, Dermot, or should I move on?
Yeah, it was just that, but having said that, and it does cause, I think it's 2 or 3 people out of 10,000 get very serious gastrointestinal bleeding. But you have to balance that against, despite all of the cautions I've said, you have to balance that against the fact that in people of middle age, in their late 40s and early 50s, this can be a drug that saves lives. In small 75 milligram doses, in consultation with your doctor, if you go on a prescription of this, it can save lives. And I know this personally because my father, who was a surgeon himself, he had a heart attack back in, it was about 20 years ago now, just coming on to 20 years ago. One of the reasons I first became interested in aspirin was because of this. And he had to have a triple bypass operation, and he was very close to death. When he recovered, fortunately, he started taking aspirin. He had some very far-sighted colleagues who were also doctors who put him on a daily dose of aspirin. And he's still alive now, and he's in his late 80s, and he's as fit now as he ever was. Now, he obviously lifestyle is important and diet is important and all of these things. Aspirin won't if you continue to smoke cigarettes, for example, then aspirin's not going to do much for you in that case. But if you're a reasonably healthy person and you have a reasonably healthy lifestyle, aspirin can indeed prolong your life.
Just one more thing. Alan Edward in New Jersey says he once saw a documentary that said aspirin is incredibly stable as a compound and that even if it was manufactured 100 years ago, it would still be efficacious. But they put expiration dates on the bottles. Why?
Yeah, it is stable, but if it's it's not stable if it's in the solution. So if it's get the water inside, it's going to be
so then it will deteriorate then.
Yeah, it will deteriorate, yeah.
Thank you both so much for being on today's Please Explain. I've been talking with Dr. Alan Arslan, assistant professor in the departments of obstetrics and gynecology and environmental medicine at NYU Langone Medical Center, and from London, Dermot Jeffries, author of Aspirin, The Remarkable Story of a Wonder Drug, which is published by Bloomsbury. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.